Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. The impact of the Palm Sunday attacks in Egypt have been pretty radical, pretty intense. And what ISIS is doing is very intentional. They've got a method and a way of doing their terrorism, which we want to figure out more about. We want to learn more about it. Karen Ellis is really an ambassador for International Christian Response. She comes to us this morning via Skype. Karen, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm living it up. It's just, it's tax day. Come on. Have you got yours done? I assume you do.
Yes, we are ahead of schedule this year. We actually went out and celebrated being done on Saturday night. went out to dinner.
That's a worthy celebration.
It is. It really is.
Well, I would love to process some of the impact of the Palm Sunday attack in Egypt and what the Christian response is in spite of all this carnage.
It's been a long week, and I think people need to understand that what happened in Tanta and Alexandria is actually happening all over the world every day. We are in an unprecedented season, actually, of attacks on people who profess to be Christians, whether they're Christian in by heart circumcision or whether they're Christian in name only because their identity card says they're a Christian, that their government has issued to them. There's an unprecedented spate of attacks on believers around the world. And this is one of those ones that, because it was so heinous and so brazen, actually made it into the media and into the public consciousness. But this sort of thing has been happening and on the rise for at least the last 15 to 20 years. So it's while people's attention is actually drawn to it, it's an excellent time to remind folks that there's an unusual movement happening, which is resulting in an unusual movement of what we at International Christian Response call not just Christian persecution, but Christian perseverance. And it really causes us here in the West to turn our eyes and hearts to understanding how do you keep going under circumstances mm-hmm. like this? What are the results of living under conditions like this, where it's you're considered a criminal, or you're considered unwanted or a second class citizen in society just because of your faith in Christ?
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about my complaint about church on Sunday when they're using the hazelnut coffee, which is not my favorite.
Yeah, it puts things in perspective, doesn't
it?
It really does.
44 people were killed, 100 others were injured, and yet there is an opportunity to look at the unity and cohesion of the people and how they continue to persevere, which should be an inspiration to all of us.
It is. It is. And the unity that is manifested in times like this isn't just limited to the Christian community. I have to say that a lot of the Muslim population, the moderate Muslim population, has actually been extremely supportive in the aftermath of the attacks. The Ahmadiyya community, which is also a repressed religious minority in the region, their humanitarian work has been impressive. You don't have to be a Christian to respond. You just have to be a human being to understand that people should be able to worship freely. That's what Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is all about, is that everyone has the right to change their religion, to worship God as they see fit, and that government should protect that right. So it'll be interesting in the aftermath to see how President al-Sisi of Egypt continues to respond to protecting this particular group of marginalized Christians in his country.
Yeah, marginalized is probably a good way to think of it, Karen. I mean, I know that they face opposition from this Islamic extremist for being Christian. Then they suffer on some level from governmental and societal persecution. They really are second-class citizens there, aren't they?
They are. I as an African American woman myself, I kind of liken it to living under Jim Crow laws, or what they used to call the Black Codes in the U.S. South after the Civil War. And these laws protected segregation of institutions and schools and businesses and hotels and suppressed voting rights, and limited a targeted population's involvement in society, including their economic and their political advancement. There's an article in The Atlantic by Samuel Tedros that captured the universality of these kinds of dehumanizing dynamics, even though the Copts have lived different periods of time in Egypt in periods of relative peace with their neighbors. He says that even at the height of Egypt's experiment with liberalism from 1923 to 1952, a Copt could never really escape his Coptic identity. Mm-hmm. For example, couldn't hold political office, or he couldn't bring it to public square. They still, to this day, it's very difficult to achieve high public office. So dehumanizing dynamics aren't limited to race, but they just kind of reflect this tendency of any dominant culture to oppress the rights of people that they've deemed other. And if you look across at the history, at these common denominators, I teach a class called Theological Dynamics of Human Rights. You can see this same familiar melody, this pattern throughout history. It just has a little bit slightly different beat every time you see the melody, hear the melody played.
Karen, you say that this particular attack got the media's attention. What is the significance of this attack on the Coptic Christian churches in Tanta and Alexandria? And why was this one significant, and why did this one capture the media's attention?
Well, there are a lot of different, the scale of the attack, first off, that it was on Palm Sunday, the symbolic reference of choosing Palm Sunday, a high holy day, probably chosen for mass impact in terms of people gathering in one space. Now, if it had been done during the week, there would have been a whole lot more people shopping and in the public square and in the marketplace. But why the symbolism of an attack on a high holy day like Palm Sunday or like Easter? It's psychological. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of it is some people are saying that the head of the Coptic Church, Pope Tewodros, may have also been a target. Pope Tewodros released a statement about 2 days ago. He says that most of Egypt's Muslims are moderate, all of the Christians are moderate, and they stood together peacefully against the Muslim Brotherhood and against the radical policies of Mohamed Morsi just 1 year into his presidency. But he felt that, he says, these violent terrorist groups really violate the norms of humanity. And in order to do that, you have to, as I said, choose times that are psychologically terrorizing. People say you shouldn't mix politics and religion, but in these cases, they're inseparable because of the nature of radical Islam. And then the third, another third reason that people, that this was such a brazen attack that filtered into the consciousness of the media is the notion that there is a push to drive Christians from the Middle East. And this particular attack was not a one-off attack. This particular attack on these two very large churches, essentially what we would consider mega churches here in the West in terms of size, this particular attack wasn't a one-off. This has been a spate of murders that have happened since December. They've been ramping up. Mm-hmm. Attacks on murders on individuals, and so much so that they've actually driven a lot of people from that region in northern Sinai out of their homes. And people have said, "No, we're not going to deal with this anymore. We don't know who's going to be next." So this isn't. This was a. It to the media, it may seem like this was a one event, but it's actually a ramping up of events in the region.
Mm-hmm. Karen, I'm going to take a little break. When I come back, I want to ask you about, I think it's pretty much illegal to, if you're a Muslim, to convert to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And yet I think the church is growing over in Egypt. I want to ask you about that and talk about that. It's 17 minutes after the hour. After a short break, we'll be back more with Karen Ellis. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold sitting in today for Bill Arnold. You know, I'm speaking to Karen Ellis, and she's coming to us via Skype, and I promise she is making me appear smarter than I am, which I'm very grateful for, Karen. I swear. This is so very interesting conversation.
Those are very kind words.
Well, they're true. They're true. Let's talk about if you're a Muslim, you can't legally convert to Christianity. Otherwise, you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
Especially in Egypt, and the Muslim background believers, they're coming to Christ. What's up with that?
It's amazing. It used to be a number of years ago that the stories and the testimonies of Christ appearing to Muslims in dreams and had them having a conversion experience out of that was rare. It's become so common now that it's the story is, oh yeah, that's, you hear the story and you say, yep, that's how it is. That's how he brings some folks to, and that, let me tell you, you know, I'm a solid covenantal theology type girl that really challenges my theological categories, but I can't limit how God is going to move. I can't say what he will or will not do. That's up to him to decide. But, you know, you talk about a tragedy like we saw last week in Egypt, in the Middle East, and this is where the concepts of perseverance come in. There are people on the ground helping Christians and Muslims understand what Christ has to say about this kind of suffering and this kind of pain and this kind of isolation. And somehow in this region, in spite of efforts to kill her, the church grows. Mm. The notion of Christians leaving the Middle East is very real. The notion, so I don't want to minimize that. The notion of the fact that there may one day not be a human testimony to Christ is very real. But you can't, you may be able to drive Christians out of the region, but you cannot drive Christ out of the region, because he always leaves a testimony of himself. Mm-hmm. We hear of Christ in the refugee camps. We hear of Christ, like I was just saying, appearing to people in dreams. We hear of Christ comforting people in prison when they're by themselves and they don't have a community around them. I can affirm that the number of Bible-believing Christians is growing in Egypt and in the Middle East, in different countries, in different situations, both with people converting from other religions as well as nominal Christians coming to a deeper understanding of Christ and the Christian faith. And the numbers and the rapid rate of growth would surprise most people. I can't tell you exactly how they function in public, but I do know that they are present. Christ's word is powerful. It is going forward. And he is drawing a people to himself in the midst of all of this.
Mm-hmm. Karen, you recently wrote an article for Christianity Today about the Christians who are living under a communist regime and some of the persecution that they're dealing with. And the desire for social change is only good if it's tempered by the gospel. Would you talk about that a little bit?
I'd had a dear friend I was talking with about what is the wisdom he had gained of watching temporal revolutions come and go in his country. And he said to me, he said, and it was I had to sit down and think about it for a while. He said to me one concept broken down. He said, revelation is a stronger force than revolution. And he said, by revelation, I mean the wisdom and knowledge that's revealed to us by God that we need to navigate this world and the unseen realms. But by revolution, I mean the overthrow of an existing order in favor of a new order. A lot of people are talking about revolution, around the globe. Lots of class struggles, a lot of folks age 18 to 29 wondering about their futures, rightly wondering about their futures and what is the best system to live under. This fellow that I spoke with seemed to say that if your revolution isn't infused with revelation, then all you have at the end of the day is just another power shift and another group of people with oppressive dynamics, because people, our human nature is always to make somebody an ideal human and somebody an other that is not that ideal human. And if you have revelation infused in that, he felt, if you have revelation, the revelation of Christ infused in that, then the ideal human that we're all striving to be is the person of Christ, with ethics that support humanity, that support the humanization of all people, and toward human flourishing as it was intended to be by God in the garden.
Mm-hmm. And so I love this quote, revelation is a stronger force than revolution.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Under revolution alone, power just shifts from one set of hands
it does,
to another.
It? Yeah,
it's the hunger for dominance rather than the hunger for humanity's flourishing.
Right. I just want to sit on that one for a minute.
We all have this tendency. We all need to have that worked out. You know, we need to work that out in all of us because, you know, everybody likes being on top. Did you ever play King of the Mountain when you were
a kid? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you get up to the top of the mountain. When you're getting up, you're scrapping up to the top of the mountain and you're stepping on people. And you get up to the top. And what's the thing that you say when you get, you get to the top and you say, let there be peace in the land.
Let there be no
dissent among the people, right? That's our human nature. And Christ is, you know, it's not going to be perfect until he comes and the government sits on his shoulders. For the Christian believer, that is when things will be made right. But if we're intending to reflect that here on earth, then as we pursue governments and government systems that treat everyone equitably, then we have to infuse our revolution with revelation. Otherwise, we're just setting ourselves up to repeat the history, the dynamics of history over and over and over again.
Yeah, Karen, so a little word of encouragement for our listeners this morning.
Oh, do not fear.
Love
do
it.
Not fear.
Love it.
Do not fear. I tell myself that every morning. I get up and I say to myself, what am I afraid of? I work with a group of people that face fear every day.
Right.
What right do I have to be afraid of anything? Knowing that my Father is a good, loving Father, that he's sovereign over all things, over all the affairs of men, that he superintends all those things. What do I have to fear?
Mm-hmm.
Don't make me fearful, God. Make me wise.
Yeah. Karen,
Karen,
I just got a message from the station manager that said, Karen is so good, if you don't get her off the air soon, I'll be offering her your job.
That's hilarious.
So I'm done with you for now. But thank you. And please come back again on the show. And thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You bet. It's 27 minutes after the hour. Coming up next, we have Mike Ferris going to be coming on the show talking about Neil Gorsuch's first day on the bench. That should be good. We're going to talk a little bit news before that, but we got lots of show coming up. Hang in there. 27 minutes after the hour. Be right back.